You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi. People across Oregon are facing a punishing combination of high costs, housing, healthcare, gas, and groceries. Now, the sweeping changes to the federal food assistance program known as SNAP are starting to hit the state. OPB's Bryce Doyle reports.
This is our beef freezer. Usually it's pretty full.
Eddie Nelson is the manager of a food bank in Dallas, Oregon. It's tucked beside a car wash and a highway that cuts through town. Here, at the end of July, the line stretches around the corner as monthly food stamp benefits dry up. But lately, the shelves are thinning out.
But as you can tell, our freezers are getting empty. This freezer here, I think, is totally empty.
A hunger crisis is looming over Oregon, and a series of challenges are converging at once. As families contend with the soaring cost of food, the federal government is slashing its food stamp program, SNAP. The changes could reshape the safety net in Oregon. One in six people here rely on SNAP, which helps fuel grocery stores, farmers, and the state's food economy. Food banks and other programs are helping record numbers of people, but some say they're running low on food because of cuts to their federal food supply. In Dallas, Nelson is having to buy more food than she ever has. The demand has only grown, so much so that volunteers had to use the women's bathroom as an extra check-in area.
You know, we're a country of abundance, and I have a hard time with the abundance being so controlled and restricted.
The pandemic heightened food insecurity across the country. It disrupted the supply chain as inflation increased and many people lost their jobs. But the problem hasn't abated.
Okay. And this is considered a slow day.
On a recent day in Dallas, the shelves in the food bank were stocked with canned tuna, rice and beans, ramen, tortilla chips, and more. Fresh fruit covered a table beside bags of hot dog buns. For its visitors, the food bank was a respite from surging grocery prices.
My food stamps are never enough for the whole month. It's like I wouldn't eat if this wasn't here.
It's very hard. Because you feel like sometimes you're not a good person because you can't really feed your kids.
I feel bad. I feel like there's a lot more people like that are worse off than us, and I feel almost selfish coming. But sometimes, like, you have to.
That's Jennifer Bullis, Karina Campbell, and Alexis Arachiga. Most of the people who visited the food bank were on food stamps, but many had had those benefits reduced or cut entirely. It's been more than a year since congressional Republicans passed their tax and spending law, widely known as the One Big Beautiful Bill. The legislation added new work requirements and slashed safety net programs like SNAP. Republicans say SNAP had grown too large and the cuts were sorely needed to eliminate fraud and encourage work. But Democrats say the bill's changes are deepening the pain on struggling families while disproportionately benefiting the wealthy. In June, 126,000 fewer Oregonians were receiving SNAP benefits compared to the same time last year. On a clear Friday morning, Wes and Jennifer Miller fill up their car with bags of food and set out with a list of addresses. They're volunteers for a local nonprofit called the Kindness Club. When it began in 2017, this program served 11 kids. Last year, it served 250.
Things are so expensive, they're just trying to live and get by, but yet they can't afford food, which is super sad and hard.
In the summer, volunteers deliver food to the homes of school children. The Millers arrive at a blue house and hand a bag of food over a metal gate to Stephanie Yates LaPlante. She lives here with five children and a partner.
You can't even buy junk food like for a decent price anymore, so not like I want to.
Yates LaPlante works at a local Safeway, where she sees the rising cost of groceries. She gets by with the help of survivor benefits through Social Security. Her husband died of heart problems in 2018. This winter, she lost her SNAP benefits. Like many others, she made too much to qualify, but hardly enough to afford the rising cost of just about everything.
Food costs so much. Even with working at the grocery store, I get a discount, but minimum wage only gets so far when you have so many mouths to feed.
Have a great weekend.
Yates LaPlante headed inside with two of her children. The Millers waved goodbye and hopped in their car. The pavement turned to gravel as they rolled into the countryside, and they had seven stops to go. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
The Pacific Northwest needs to build more wind, solar, and natural gas-powered electricity, and fast. according to recommendations out Thursday. Monica Semayoa tells us more.
The Northwest Power and Conservation Council says the region needs to generate at least 11 new gigawatts of energy by 2032. That's more energy than the entire state of Oregon uses right now. According to the council, data centers are a key factor. They use enormous amounts of energy and are built much faster than new solar and wind farms. These recommendations apply to Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. The region has never built this much new energy this fast. The draft recommendations are open for public comment through October 16th. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council expects to adopt a final plan later this year. Reporting from Portland, I'm Monica Samayoa.
People gathered outside Springfield City Hall Friday to denounce federal immigration enforcement and call a community to action. KLCC's Julia Bobach was there.
Community members took turns writing messages on a sign that read, "Stop the Fear." After a Springfield resident was detained by ICE earlier this week, people at the rally said some of their neighbors are scared to leave their homes or send their kids to school next month. Johannes Tadeo with La Gente Unido de Lane says the rally was a chance for community members to show they have their neighbors' backs.
A lot of time, folks don't really have an insight of what's going on in our communities, and sometimes people turn away. And this gives them an opportunity to be able to see, hear, direct from families, and be able to find ways that they could be able to help and support. Because it does feel like a really lonely time right now to live in Springfield.
Organizers of the event say they hope to continue gathering the community for proactive opportunities to learn about and support residents in need. In Springfield, I'm Julia Bobach,
ICE,
reporting.
Wildfires have closed two sections of the Pacific Crest Trail in Washington, including the trail's final 40 miles before the Canadian border. A Beaverton man has helped soften the disappointment of long-distance hikers turned back before reaching the end. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
Long-distance hiker Ian Irwin had to stop at the unexpected closure in the North Cascades after walking all the way from the Mexican border.
Definitely disappointing, but it felt okay that it was something that was outside of our control. So it wasn't like we were quitting or giving up or anything. It was just this year, this is where the end of the trail is going to be.
Longer fire seasons in the Northwest's warming climate have made completing the long hike difficult. In the past 5 years, fires have closed 200 miles of the trail in Washington. Irwin and his hiking partners thought their big hike was still worth celebrating, so a friend brought up some scrap wood and power tools, and they built a hand-lettered monument, a copy of the real monument at the Canadian border. Hikers who started 2,500 miles away still get to celebrate their monumental accomplishment with a selfie in front of a monument. I'm John Ryan reporting.
More than 6,000 people have been deployed to fight fires across Oregon. And as OPB's Courtney Sherwood reports, keeping them fed, clothed, and clean is a job of its own.
This week, professional hotshots dug trenches by hand to contain the Hagen Fire. Farmers and ranchers drew on volunteer training to battle the Grasshopper Fire. And at the Wright's Spring Fire, fire lines were built by dozer operators who work for timber companies. There are a lot of people fighting fires in Oregon. And Fire Logistics Chief James Page says it can take a village to support a firefighting team. Here's Page with an update on new support coming to crews at the Big Grass Fire.
We will have a fully operating catering unit. We've got a second shower unit coming in. We're shipping laundry down and doing a bag and tag service so that they can decontaminate after working on the fire line.
The Big Grass is the largest wildfire in the country, but Page says even smaller fire camps try to at least serve daily hot meals. I'm Courtney Sherwood, reporting.
Manzanita City Council has appointed an interim city manager, but has also identified four finalists to consider for a permanent position. The city is in the middle of searching for a new top administrator following the resignation of Layla Amon in March. Council originally decided the remaining staff could manage the city with Finance Director Nina Christ as interim city manager, but realized in the following months that staff was spread too thin. Dave Waffle was appointed as interim at a recent meeting. He brings more than four decades of experience in city government to the position and will split responsibilities with Christ. Meanwhile, four finalists for the permanent role will be in Manzanita for an August 25th town council to meet residents. There will be panel interviews with community members and city staff on the 26th, with the goal of selecting a candidate and making an offer on the 28th. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Now moving to news from Washington. The owners of the Tacoma immigration lockup say they'll soon be starting talks with immigration and customs enforcement officials to sell a number of their facilities nationwide. That could include the Tacoma Detention Center. KUOW's Gustavo Segrero reports.
Many see this as a part of an ongoing strategy to avoid local accountability at privately operated facilities like the Tacoma one. Naina Gupta is policy director at the American Immigration Council.
As we watch the federal government use the billions of dollars they received from Congress to buy these facilities, we're seeing both a decrease in accountability and oversight.
A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson told Time magazine local government intervention is getting in the way of keeping these private facilities operational. Both ICE and GEO Group, which own the Tacoma facility, would not comment on the potential sale, but GEO Group's founder told investors they aim to wrap up pricing negotiations of any sale as soon as late September. I'm Gustavo Sagrero reporting.
On August 1st, three wildfires flared up in the Spokane area. For hundreds of people, the Spokane Transit Authority was instrumental in helping them evacuate potentially dangerous areas. By sheer coincidence, the supervisor at the Transit Authority who coordinated the evacuation effort had been in a similar situation before. NWPB's Eric Bengel reports.
Sarah Addington is a supervisor at Spokane Transit Authority. 3 years ago, she was in the communications role when the Gray Fire burned through the nearby city of Medical Lake. Supervisors like Addington frequently change shifts and rotate positions. Yet she found herself in the same role when the Old Trails Fire erupted on August 1st.
My first thought was, I wonder if this is going to be very similar, and it was.
For both fires, she was responsible for coordinating evacuations. This time, though, one of the people she had to evacuate was her 71-year-old father. He was being treated for Parkinson's disease at the nearby Veterans Medical Center and was put on a bus along with other VA patients and taken to safety.
And it sort of just put it into perspective that it's not just people we're getting onto a bus. It's someone's dad, grandfather, mother, nurses, doctors, whoever needed to be evacuated in the moment.
Even though Addington was the focal point of communications that day, she gives credit to her coworkers who also stepped up.
My specific shift that day may have been the center of it, but it is a whole team.
The Spokane Transit Authority helped evacuate more than 800 people that day. In Walla Walla, I'm Eric Bengel.
A California team has overseen the response to the Spokane area wildfires. More than 100 people make up the team. SPR's Audrey Nelson looked into how these complex incident management groups are dispatched and how California Team 7 ended up in Spokane.
On Friday, July 31st, Incident Commander Tom Clemo and his team had just arrived in Baker City, Oregon. Clemo's group is known as California Complex Incident Management Team 7. They were getting ready to take over command of a wildfire from another team. Then Clemo's phone rang. It was a coordination center in Portland. They told Team 7 to get back in their vehicles and go to Spokane, where three dangerous fires had broken out.
So within 15 minutes, 127 of us had checked out of hotels and we were northbound.
Clemo spent the five-hour drive calling Spokane administrators and officials and getting up to speed.
We actually have a guideline on how to assume command in what we call a hot handoff, and this really couldn't have been a hotter handoff.
Team 7 is one of 38 incident management teams in the nation. They're dispatched to Northwest disasters by the Northwest Interagency Coordination Center. Areas with active wildfires are given a preparedness level, 1 to 5. 1 is the least dangerous, and 5 the most.
So when we reach a preparedness level 4 or 5 in an area, it means that you're going to have to bring in resources from outside the area.
That's Jean Nelson-Dean with the Northwest Coordination Center. Her center works with the National Multi-Agency Coordinating Group, which figures out how to dispatch those 38 incident teams across the country.
So they are constantly looking at the data, what's available, what's going where are the priorities, and priorities are often like values at risk.
By values at risk, Nelson-Dean means communities or protected areas being threatened by fires.
And based on the complexity of an incident, based on values at risk, they make determinations about where a CIM team is going to go.
According to Nelson Dean, when the Spokane fires broke out, the dispatching system worked exactly as intended. The Northwest region was at a preparedness level of 5. The wind had shifted, so fires threatened Spokane's residential communities. And here's where Spokane got matched with Team 7. Down in Oregon, Tom Clemo and his group were well-rested and ready to go.
That's kind of a success story of the system, right? I mean, that's the goal, is that like something like that happens, we had a team ready. Well, they were ready to go to another fire, but could immediately be shifted and dispatched over to take on the Spokane fires.
Most of the members of California Team 7 live in California. But Deputy Incident Commander John Lucas says that as fires in the Northwest have worsened, Team 7 has seen more assignments farther from home.
It's kind of funny. We haven't had a fire in California in the last 3 years. We've been basically up here in Washington and Oregon. And Montana.
This Sunday, Team 7 will finally go back to California. There, after 3 days of mandated rest, many team members will return to their day jobs as firefighters. I'm Audrey Nelson, reporting.
As house prices soar in Pacific County, a new nonprofit is looking to create a pathway to homeownership. Coastal Communities Land Trust acquires and stewards land in a defined area, retaining ownership of the land and providing long-term affordable ground leases to homeowners or other entities. The trust was founded under the umbrella of the Pacific County Economic Development Council, or EDC, which is covering costs for the first 18 to 24 months as the land trust works to build income and revenue streams. The median house price in Pacific County saw a nearly 70% increase since the COVID-19 pandemic. While other organizations in the county are focused on developing housing at the lowest economic thresholds, the EDC is particularly concerned with workforce housing efforts. Board members for the Land Trust say the housing crisis is impacting hiring in local government and at local hospitals. Coastal Communities Land Trust opened last month and currently only has the capacity to act as a land bank. EDC Executive Director Sue Yerku says if someone wants to leave a property in their will, or if a public entity wants to set a property aside, the trust could potentially steward that. The Land Trust's charter also mentions holding property for community benefit, which gives them the flexibility to steward or manage commercial property. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Local and regional news is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. For more local and regional news, go to kmun.org/news. American Democracy Minute is up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A head-turning poll released April 6th found 49% of Americans are concerned that President Donald Trump will order the military to seize ballots and voting machines during the 2026 midterms. When surveyed in mid-February by the States United Democracy Center, 81% of Democrats, 40% of Independents, and 19% of Republicans responded they were very or somewhat concerned Trump could take such an action. The poll also asked whether the president should be able to issue an executive order to cancel the 2026 midterms. Trump had suggested on January 14th, we shouldn't even have an election, unquote, and expressed a similar sentiment in a January 6th speech. In the poll results, 71% of Americans somewhat or strongly disagree, including 59% of Republicans. Disturbingly, 13% of Republicans somewhat or strongly agree the president has that power, despite the Constitution's Article 1, Section 2 mandate requiring congressional elections be held every 2 years. Trump's March 2025 order on elections was largely struck down by multiple federal courts, citing the U.S. Constitution's grant of election administration to the states and Congress, not the president. His March 2026 mail-in ballot order will likely suffer the same fate. We've linked to the poll and more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.